With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. And welcome back to Dave Tindall. Hello, Dave.
Hello again. Who would have thought?
Things have changed since your last appearance, but we won't dwell on that. But all I'll say is it was either you or Andrew Neil. He's not busy now, but he wouldn't answer my call. So welcome back. Now, for those who maybe weren't with us last time you were on, just explain who exactly you are.
Yeah, well, that'll clear things up for people who think, who the heck's he? I'm a friend of the podcast, I guess. Well, I am. That came to it in lockdown, having been a subscriber to Snooker Scene magazine in the 80s. Then I kind of reconnected with snooker during lockdown, bought myself a 6x3, started playing reruns of the 1982 World Championships. Bought a Steve Davis wig like you do. I'm just sort of a good fit for this in that you like being quirky and a bit different. So maybe my presence can add a bit of strangeness to this rather than having a proper guest.
Well, this podcast is nothing if not ripped from the day's headlines, because of course you're a big noise in golf as well. And we've just had the Ryder Cup. You do podcasts and you're a sort of betting expert, I suppose.
Well, hopefully, yes.
How did you see that? I mean, you did tip an American victory, I believe.
Yeah, I did tip a sort of convincing American win. I think home advantage is a big thing in Ryder Cups, even more so. It's as the years go on, we're now not even getting close Ryder Cups. We're just getting hammerings wherever it is by the home team. And linking it back to snooker, maybe there's something I'll say later about home advantage.
Okay. I'm not a massive golf fan by any means. I dipped in and out. I found the build up unbearable. I know you were part of that, and hopefully made a few quid from it, but it was so overhyped. And of course, what happens is you get to the start of it and the crowd are just out of control. I mean, it was just kind of, you know, it just I couldn't listen to them. But also some of the coverage, and, you know, good luck to our dear friends at Sky Sports, but some of the coverage was so bombastic. I thought, yesterday's come on, the guy's gone. Could it be the day of destiny? And then they play all this music. It's just golf at the end of the day, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is a long wait. The build-up just takes forever, especially when it's in America. So you're not even getting started until afternoon on Friday. And there's so many things you can say. I'm glad I did my podcast early in the week, because I'd kind of just go around in a loop by about Wednesday afternoon. But yeah, it does get hyped, and it's like a big boxing match, isn't it? When it gets hyped and then the outcome's a bit naff. It all seems a bit embarrassing.
I just think, and we're not a golf podcast, but my final word on this, when, you know, we saw Rory McIlroy was in tears and some of the others, and they were saying, you know, this is the biggest thing in golf. I think if they took a truth serum and it was a gun to their head, surely winning the Open or the Masters has got to be ultimately bigger, isn't it? I don't know.
Well, I think that they, because they spend 52 weeks of most years playing for themselves. So individual, when they kind of get back to this team thing, I think it really does sort of get to them. They really do appreciate maybe what they haven't got as people in an individual sport. You know, they haven't got teammates like footballers or rugby players or cricketers. So I think it does really get to them, and they realise, oh, I quite miss all this camaraderie. Even kind of ice people who are tough to crack, like Brooks Koepka, I think he realised he, you know, perhaps life is about maybe just having shared experiences. So I think I do believe Rory. I think it's a bit in the moment when he says that, but I think it's genuine when he does get choked up about how his week's gone and it's not gone well, when he's been in such this close environment with a load of his buddies.
Well, there is relevance to all this, because I did last week on Twitter just float the idea of a sort of snooker version of the Ryder Cup. I mean, obviously in pool, they have the Moscone Cup, Europe, the America. In tennis this weekend, they have this thing called the Laver Cup, which is Europe against a sort of rest of the world team. Even temp in bowling, they've got the Weber Cup, you know. So there's a lot of sports have these sort of battles between continents and whatever. And my idea was maybe Europe versus Asia. So you'd obviously have a lot of Chinese Thai players in the Asian team. European team would be largely British-based, but opportunities for other players as well. I put a poll up. We had over 1,000 respondents. 60% were in favour. It's fair to say a lot of the 40% who were against were very firmly against, which surprised me a little bit, because this event doesn't exist. So it's not like, you know, it doesn't actually exist. It's just an idea. Quite a few people said, really, to make it competitive, it should be the UK against the world. I'm not in favour of that, because I think actually that would actually flag up how snooker is lagging behind other sports globally. If Britain had one team, and what you're saying is the other 200 countries of the world were all in the other team. So I do think, personally, maybe Europe against, you could say, Asia Pacific, or maybe Europe against the world as they're doing this tennis event. The exact format, how it would work, how many players, how they would be chosen, I don't know, but it was just an idea. The thing is, though, I mean, snooker feels like a very individual sport, but like you say, golf is that as well. And then suddenly when they're in a team, you can see what it matters to them. So it may be a runner, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched plenty of Moscone Cups and thought it was great, and you can see how much they're enjoying it. I do think it's a good idea. I'd want to get kind of Neil Robertson in there somehow.
Well, this is the other thing, isn't it? You know, would the players actually want to play in it? I mean, what is it actually something that would interest them? I suppose, you know, I mean, the money obviously might come into it, but there's no guarantee you would get actually the people you would want to play in it.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, going back to the kind of 80s, I think it finished in the 80s, but one of my very favourite events was that team event, when it just seemed like you had the perfect split of three good players from a certain country, like Canada, you'd have Werbeneck, Stevens, and Clift Auburn, of course. Wales, you've got Griffiths, Reardon, and Doug Mountjoy. I used to love those because it sort of had a team feel to it. I know what you're talking about is a very different format, but I still think the overall kind of idea that you get a team involved, I think it would work well just for something different. And I think it, you know, a lot of the talk about snooker in the last few years has been about sort of mental health and how difficult it is to be out on your own individually. I think a team thing would really bond people, and then that could have a knock-on effect for the rest of the season. Like, you know, friendships would develop, maybe strongly, maybe friendships for life even, and then when they're out and about, they're more likely to bond together maybe.
Well, you know, it's just an idea. As I say, 60% for what it's worth were for it, 40% not. We'll see. Like everything, it'll come down to broadcasting, sponsorship, all the rest of it.
Why would people be against it? What's the negative?
Have you not been on the internet? People are against a lot of things.
Yeah, I know it's sort of binary and you've got to be for something or against something, but what's the downside of it?
Like I say, it's the internet. People tend to be against stuff. But speaking of for and against, and this is what's known as a segue, we've been speaking recently about the Crucible. Of course, Judd Trump made his comments thinking the World Championship should move on. I was pretty clear. I didn't agree. Phil Yates was on last week. He didn't agree. He was very determinedly didn't agree. Dave, you've been to the Crucible as a spectator, as you've told us before, and I know you've got something to say on this subject.
Indeed, I do. I think if you'd asked me at any point over the last 30 years, I would have thought, oh, what a ridiculous question. It's not even up for debate. But since it's been mentioned as a possible idea that it couldn't be there, you know, Judd and Neil's comments. By the way, this is another area I want to go into shortly about the fact that they were said by Judd and Neil. Just hold that thought.
I will.
I can't believe I'm sort of thinking this now, but I feel if I just said, oh yeah, keep it there, I feel like I'm just another kind of white male from the 80s thinking, oh, you can't change this because it's always there. And I think when you're making the arguments for it, I think to some extent you are seeing it through the prism of who we are as kind of blokes in our whatever 40s, 50s, 30s, 60s, whatever, that have grown up with it. So to sort of address some of the things Phil said, I mean, that's the great Phil Yates. Who am I to question him? But I just thought I'd mention a couple of things. He said some of the great moments, back to golf here, some of the great moments in golf when the Open is at St Andrews. But I mean, the Open's only held there every 5 years. So when Shane Lowry wins at Royal Portrush, does that diminish what he achieved because it wasn't St Andrews? And then Phil says, you know, viewers, when they watch an Open at St Andrews, they see the road hole and all the history of the hotels around it and the iconic land. And you can say the same thing about the Masters. When you see the beauty of Augusta National, you can see Amen Corner, the azaleas, all the pines and the water. But viewers on TV, they're watching, sorry to sort of strip this down to the basics, viewers on TV are essentially watching a 12x6 bit of wood, baize and slate that isn't any different whether you plonked it in Sheffield or in China. Yeah, we sort of mock Americans when they talk about the World Series in baseball because sort of no one else is invited to take part apart from American teams. I know there's a bit of a debate on that, whether how it got named, but that's how it's viewed often, isn't it? That it's the World Series, there are only American teams. But this is the World Snooker Championship. So why can't it be played in other parts of the world? I think there's a sort of problem in the fact that the World Championship for snooker is essentially its be all and end all to lots of people. I mean, golf has got four majors a year and a multitude of different venues. So, you know, given that the Masters is at Augusta every year and St Andrews is at the Open is at St Andrews every 5 years, it means in any 5 year spell in golf, the biggest elite events, you're getting 16 venues in those 5 years. I mean, athletics has got a world championship that moves around. The Olympics is in a different location. But snooker's, it's not backed itself into a corner, but that's just the way it is. Snooker hasn't got the Olympics. It's once a year in the same venue. So is there not, as a slight compromise, is there not scope to maybe alternate it between the Crucible and, say, China or Australia? Because if Judd won it, I know that I'm not being very practical, but if, say, Judd won it in China, would you not say to him, oh, fair play, mate, your second world title came away from the home comforts of England, so should that not have extra merit that he's won an away world championship?
Well, on that specific point, it all boils down to the host broadcaster, which is the BBC. Now, they pay a lot of money to show it. They don't want it in another country. It's the time's difference for a start in terms of the hours they show it, the cost of showing it, of producing it, going out to China would cost a lot more. So that really is the reason it's in the UK. What you say makes a lot of sense, actually, on a pragmatic level, to move it round. And actually, this was floated about 20 years ago. snooker fans will remember there was a split in the game and there was a rival tour announced. It never happened. But one of the sort of the ideas at that time from leading players, I mean, we're talking big names. I mean, I'll mention one of them, Stephen Hendry, said he thought the World Championship should go to different venues and, like St Andrews, come back to the Crucible every 5 years. So I absolutely see the logic in it. I don't agree. I think it should. I think it should stay there because I think that venue means a lot to a lot of people, including people who've never been there. And actually, I've met people from other countries who've come over just to be at the Crucible, literally to come. It means so much to them. So I think, I mean, I made the point, sort of the commercial reasons why actually it's a good deal for snooker. I do think the history is actually important, but I can see the other side. I just don't agree with it. I'm not saying you're wrong at all. I'm just saying, and I get what you're saying about you've grown up with it. Well, that is a reason, but that informs everything we look at in life. Our experiences, you know, so I don't see that as a bad thing, but I get, but move on because you mentioned Judd and Neil, why they were important.
Well, let me throw this one at you. Mm. What have those two got in common?
Well, they're both left-handers.
There you go. That's my answer. I've ridiculously done some research about left-handers and venues.
Right.
So why might they not want it to be at the Crucible? Because they've both got pretty average records for what they should be achieving. Neil's won it once. Judd's won it once. And you can't believe that they shouldn't have won it more. So this is probably absolute hogwash and gobbledygook and madness.
Well, you're on the right podcast for that.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Well, I'm going to say it anywhere. Mm. So I worked it out, some percentages. Maybe there's something kind of in the feng shui of the Crucible that doesn't suit a left-hander because of the way their brains work. And the only exception to the left-handed argument I'm going to make is Mark Williams, but I think his brain works differently to anyone, so he doesn't count. Yeah. But even if you include him, 47 World Championships at the Crucible, just 5 left-handed winners. So that's a strike rate of 10.6%. So I looked at some of the other venues, and that is, well, shall I run down them? Do you want the percentages?
Go on, why not?
Off the top of your head, could you guess at the best venue for a left-hander?
No.
No. It's quite a new one. There's a clue.
Oh, I have no idea. Milton Keynes, maybe.
Absolutely. The Marshall Arena. Yeah. Right. So since we had Marshall Arena stepping in for COVID, 62% of the tournaments were won by a left-hander. So if I was Judd and Neil, I'd be saying, get it there. Let's play there. Because there must be something in the air. The next one down was the Arena Riga, 50%. Wow. Good one for left-handers. Alexandra Palace, 33%, still pretty good. The Tempodrome, 30% of all tournaments won there by left-handers. The Barbican, 27%. The Hexagon, going back a bit now, 20%. So all these are significantly above the 10% of the Crucible. Wembley Conference Centre dips to 14%. You've got Goths at 13%. Newport, 12%. And then the two bottom ones, the two worst venues for left-handers are the Crucible at 10.6. And the worst one of the lot, you think of a famous one I've left out?
Did you mention the Conference Centre? I can't remember.
Yes, Wembley Conference, 14%.
Wow. You see, people thought Dave Tindall was just someone who put on a wig and played snooker in his back room. But here we are. You've done some work.
Who says Tindall can't do statistics? Yeah. Nobody does. It's widely regarded as one of my strengths. the bottom one is the Preston Guild Hall with 4.7%. Wow. A graveyard for left-handers. No one said ever, but I've just said it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, where do we go from there? What I will say is, because I want to move on to another, it's related actually, this topic. But what I will say is you made a very good case there. I think you're right when you say a lot of us have an emotional connection. But I think if I didn't have an emotional connection, I probably wouldn't still be doing this job. You know, it's something that's in my blood and I would like to see it continue there. And I would be sad if it moved. But you've made a good argument. But I'm going to move on, Dave, because this is related, actually. Now, Callum Law has written in. This is what Callum says. He says, I'm just getting in touch to express my disappointment after reading about John Virgo saying he expects this season to be his and Dennis Taylor's last with the BBC. I was disappointed when the BBC got rid of Clive Everton, and I feel the same way again. To me, John and Dennis are part of a unique and ever-diminishing group of people who have seen snooker all the way from the days of Joe and Fred Davis through the 80s boom, the arrival of Stephen Hendry, class of 92, etc., right up to the current day. As a result, in my opinion, they're uniquely placed to provide insight, and I find my viewing pleasure is enhanced when John and Dennis are commentating. The one thing that always comes through with both of them, as it did with Clive, is their enthusiasm and love for the game of snooker. As John said himself, nothing lasts forever, but personally, I'll still be very sad to see him and Dennis leave. I do hope they will at least get a proper send-off from the BBC, unlike Clive, whose magnificent contribution to commentary and snooker as a whole was never properly recognised by the corporation. Well, this was an interview. Thank you, Callum, for that. This was an interview that John Virgo did on the Talking Snooker podcast with Nick Metcalf and Phil Hague last week. And it was an excellent interview. You know, John Virgo is a great figure in the sport. He's a terrific raconteur. He had some brilliant stories about the days of Big Break and so on. His contribution to snooker should be noted as a player, as a commentator. He was WPSA chairman and, of course, an all-round entertainer. John and Dennis, it's got to be said, both in their 70s, but age shouldn't always be the determining factor. Joe Biden, 78, he's president of the United States. Now, we don't actually know the specific truth. This was John Virgo said he was led to believe this was going to happen. Broadcasters, it's got to be said, are often keen to make a statement to show they're changing. Sky did it a couple of years ago. They dropped David Gowrie and Botham from their cricket coverage, two legendary England cricketers. Personally, I thought Gower was excellent and his intelligence and his analysis have been much missed. BBC did it, as Callum said, when they dropped Clive. Then they wanted to demonstrate they were becoming a bit more chatty, a bit more based on characters, coverage based around the personalities of the players. It also became much less journalistic. And I think people probably know my opinion on this, but to me, dropping Clive is a bit like the Rolling Stones dropping Mick Jagger. You know, probably the first time they've been compared to each other. Change for the sake of it doesn't always work, is the point. There's a lot to be said for experience. JV and Dennis represented snooker very well for a long time. They both played at the Crucible in 1977, the first year. Someone actually this very weekend, uploaded onto YouTube coverage of the 81 World Final, BBC coverage. Dennis Taylor is a studio pundit, so that's 40 years ago. JV in the interval was shown doing his impressions. So, you know, you've got to salute them as legends of the sport. But the other side is, Virgo also said something in this interview, which does in part explain the criticisms Judd Trump made of the BBC before the World Championship and the criticisms that a lot of snooker fans have. He said that Trump had had a disappointing season. Well, the fact is he won 5 ranking titles and he ended it as world number one. That's not a disappointing season. The problem is he didn't win any of the 3 events that the BBC themselves televise. Yeah. And this is the charge against the BBC. It's that their coverage exists in its own vacuum and it's not helped. I'm going to bring it up again. It's not helped by World Snooker Tour championing this Triple Crown series, which to me has created a 2-tier circuit, which sometimes feels like the other events don't exist or don't matter, even though they're all equally difficult to win. Casual fans who only watch the BBC may not care about that. Ardent snooker fans certainly do. And even casual fans still want information on the players. It's not good enough for a commentator to start a broadcast saying they don't know anything about the players they're watching. Now, what I've noticed, of course, is, and this goes back to our dear friends on Twitter, many of the people who actually very much agreed with Trump before the Crucible are now the same people saying John and Dennis should be kept on. Such is the sort of amnesia of social media. The fact is this. Look, it's up to the BBC who they want to employ. John and Dennis have had a very good run. Some will want them to continue. Some will want to hear different voices. One thing's for sure, as we know with commentary, you won't please everybody. What I will say, as a fan of the sport, I think it will be a sad day if we don't hear them again. They have both put in great service. We'll see. I suppose it's just the natural order of things. They will be phased out. But do you have any strong opinions on this, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I listened to that podcast. It was really enjoyable. I sent Nick a text saying, well done for asking John about his political views compared to Jim Davidson's.
Yeah.
Which John wisely dodged, I think. I don't really get it why. It's not like John Virgo and Dennis kind of run onto the screen dancing and sort of showing themselves in front of the camera. I can see why maybe in front of the camera people might want a sort of younger face, but I think you can't beat experienced voices, and they lend themselves to sport. I mean, so many off the top of my head, you know, Peter O'Sullivan in racing, obviously Ted Lowe in snooker, I mean, even now in football, you've got Martin Tyler. I mean, how long has he been doing that?
Well, since the 70s, actually.
Yeah. It's incredible. You sort of play an old clip and you think, is that Martin Tyler commentator? and it still is, and he's still got relevance, and he's still, you know, a sharp analyst on the game. And I think Dennis and John, yeah, it saddens me that. When I heard that, I thought, oh, no. I know you could argue this is possibly contradicting what I've said about, you know, snooker maybe moving on a bit, but I'd rather those two went out on their own terms, because I still think you've got a lot to offer. I still think you can mix. I don't see why it has to be so definitive when you think, right, that's them done. Why can't you just have a mix of them and a few?
Well, it may be, to be fair, it may be that we don't know for sure, because John, what he was saying was that's the impression he's been given. I don't think it's absolutely definitive. I know that IMG, who make the snooker programs for the BBC, they've won the contract again for that, so they're continuing. But as I say, sometimes broadcasters, and it will be the BBC's decision, like to make statements to show that they've changed. They made one at the World Championship. They brought in Trump and Jack Lazowski after Judd's comments. So they did actually, you know, very much react to that. I don't know. I suppose the question is, you know, how long should people go on? I mean, there have been examples of great broadcasters. David Coleman was one who probably went on too long because kind of no one sort of wanted to say, sorry, David, but maybe you'll have to stand down.
Yeah, but, you know, they seem a long way from that stage. I think you can't buy kind of an experienced voice as a commentator. It's part of the whole thing. It's not just the players, you know, involved in the action. The commentator can bring so much to it, and you can't just get any old Tom, Dick and Harry to come in. So they're worth their weight in gold, people like John Virgo and Dennis Taylor. I'd be you know, very sad to see them go.
I agree, except I do think there's an issue with, and I'm not criticising anyone in particular, but if you're going to do the job, you have to be across stuff, you know. And to say Judd Trump had a disappointing season, he didn't. Okay, he didn't win the world. He played in three BBC events. Well, in fact, he played in two BBC events. He couldn't play in the Masters because he had COVID. The UK Championship, he lost 10-9 on the pink in the final. And the World Championship, he got to the quarters. So even those three events, actually, they weren't that disappointing.
Yeah, but does that not... Is this not sort of we're going around in, we're kind of back to where we were? Is that maybe not John's opinion that the World Championship is massive? And if Judd doesn't win that, surely you'd say Ronnie O'Sullivan had a disappointing season if he won a few times but didn't win the world, wouldn't you? I sounds a bit too much, kind of like he's ignored everything else. But
I think you're right. I think, but put it this way, okay, where I would agree with you about that and Virgo about that is Judd Trump. I said this before, to be regarded as a great snooker player, you have to win, I think, multiple world titles, definitely. And you have to win, but you also have to win lots of other tournaments. If you look at the greats, Davis, Hendry, O'Sullivan, John Higgins, William Selby, so there's five all-time greats. They've all done that. They've all won multiple world titles. They've all won lots of other tournaments. Judd Trump so far has won lots of other tournaments. He's won one world title, but he's 32, so we don't know, you know, how many more he'll win and what his career will look like at the end of it. You can't really judge him until, you know, down the line. So you could, I understand what JV's saying, not stepping up to the plate in the World Championship, but you can't just ignore everything else he's done, I suppose. And I'm not saying he did, but I think that comment was a bit glaring. I know a lot of players have picked up on it online and said, what are you talking about? Anyway, I want to move on because we've got other emails I want to get to. Glenn Shaw, he says, I'm Canadian here. I grew up in North America's fast food pool, but much prefer snooker's cerebral demands, colourful personalities and elegant approach. So new to the sport and really appreciate your podcast. Always interesting. Thanks so much. Two questions, if that's okay. One, why do snooker players tend to tap their bridge hand and or middle fingers as they flutter, prepare for their shot? Two, why do snooker players tend to age out? Ronnie Higgins and Williams excluded, of course. Mental pressures, eyesight, personal time commitments. On the first one, I mean, Tony Meo was the most famous.
I was about to say that.
Yeah, he used to do this.
I used to copy that because I saw Tony Meo do it.
That's exactly it. I think so many people did that and they didn't know why they were doing it. They just seen Meo do it on telly. So they thought, oh, well, that's something you do. I mean, I think it's partly a nerves thing. It's partly, some people have suggested it's sort of about timing the shot. Yeah. But yeah, I think that kind of is it. And the second one, In theory, okay, snooker's not a physical sport, so why shouldn't older players be able to continue? I definitely think eyesight is an issue. Your eyesight typically starts to change in your 40s. I've seen, for example, Graham Dott wearing glasses, you know, when he's not playing. And that's got to have an effect on how you play, because, you're seeing things differently. Now, those three, the Holy Trinity, Ronnie, John Higgins and Mark Williams, they seem just immune from all of that stuff at the moment. At the moment. But, you know, that's not to say it won't change. I think that will be the reason they start to decline. I think it will be eyesight. They all keep themselves, you know, reasonably fit, and they don't live wild lifestyles or anything. So I think that could be it. I think eyesight could be the reason. But, you know, Fred Davis, yeah, he wore glasses and he played at the Crucible at the age of 70. So it's not necessarily a career ender, but it might start the decline possibly.
Yeah, wasn't it? Didn't Anthony Hamilton have sort of laser surgery and it didn't go quite as well as he thought?
Yeah, and the other side of that is Judd Trump had it, and that was just before he had sort of eyesight issues. He had laser surgery; it went really well, needless to say, and that's just before he started his amazing run. So I definitely think it's something that's not really talked about, but I definitely think it is an issue.
I mean, personally, I thought I had brilliant vision up until the age of 40, and then I took my son to get a pair of glasses, and I kind of was trying to join in with his test and I couldn't see it. I do sometimes wonder though, what is it about the ice? I mean, I still play snooker now without glasses and don't need them. What can't you see?
No, I think it's your perspective changes.
Right.
Sort of the near vision changes, and you're maybe just not seeing things quite the same way. You're not quite seeing them as sharply, maybe, as before. I mean, we've already mentioned Dennis, of course, you know, famously winning in glasses. And to me, people talk about the nature of that final, understandably, because it went to the last black. But the great achievement for me as someone who wears glasses was the fact that he won it in a pair of, you know, glasses that he was sort of ribbed for and you know, mocked for when he first started wearing them. But needless to say, he had the last laugh.
He did.
Jack Carnham, yeah, he was an optician, weirdly, as well as a snooker commentator. He made them. I'm going to move on. We've got one more email, and then, in fact, we've got two more emails. James Heat, I enjoyed your conversation with Phil Yates about the US Open pool. Do you happen to know why they racked using a template in the earlier rounds and a conventional triangle in the later rounds? Well, James, I've looked into this, and apparently it's because they had so many tables that the sort of senior referees obviously couldn't referee all of them, so it was easier to use that template, and then, as you say, later on they switched to the triangle. So just because they had so many matches to get through, apparently that was the reason. Paul Mastrelli, now this is about the British Open. Paul has sent his idea for what the format should be. Now, obviously, we're an audio service, so we can't actually see it, but he does give some explanation. It comes down to starting 3 days earlier. He wants to start it on the Friday. He says, to cater for the four-table format, much smoother transition between rounds. The tournament would have to be elongated by a few days. He says the draw for each round should take place live on ITV4. And, you can't see what he's sent, so it's kind of a bit redundant me talking about it, other than to say the problem really, Paul, is it's elongating the tournament, because that adds cost. It adds cost to hiring the venue. It would add production costs for the broadcaster, significant, if you're going to do three more days. I think possibly the solution, because it was a very busy event, although they got through the matches, you know, they got through them pretty well, but maybe just filter a few out with qualifiers. That's what they're doing for the Home Nations. Let's be honest, you know, we're all snooker fans, but there are some matches there that you don't need to see at the venue. The other thing is ITV4, who the broadcaster for the British Open this season, they're also at the mercy of live racing. So there's some afternoons, like the last afternoon, they couldn't show any snooker because they had racing on. They have to share with other sports. So that comes into all formats. In terms of having the draw for every round live, the problem with that is it goes on forever in the early rounds. I mean, if you do the draw for the last 64, you know, that's 32 matches you've got to pull out. 64 names, obviously. That takes about 15 minutes. Not great telly, really. Will Snooker did the draw in the players' room, which was not great telly either, but it wasn't live. They just put it on YouTube. But thanks for you've thought about it, which is good, and you did say feel free to send this on, so I will send it on, and we'll see what they say. Maybe they'll go for it, in which case I'll hail you a genius. But that's the issue, I think, lengthening the tournament, because broadcasters pay for a certain number of days. The venue is hired for a certain number of days. So if that is increased, then the cost is also increased. Did you see any of the British Open, Dave?
Yeah, bits and bobs. Mm. And I agree with that. I like format changes or people who think about them in depth.
No, it was very in depth. I just I haven't worked out a way to actually show it on screen because we don't have a screen.
No,
because we're a podcast.
We are. I also did watch quite a bit of the pool. I'm one of these idiots who watches a bit of it and thinks I could win that, and then clearly I'd get absolutely hammered all over the place. But I used to play. Leeds is obviously famous for the Northern Snooker Centre, which is up for sale.
Yeah.
Big I saw news, you put that.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. I hope it's not some bloke who wants to renovate flats or something.
Well, that's the concern, isn't it? I mean, because it's 47 years the Williamsons have owned that. And it was, you know, the key thing about the Northern is it opened before the snooker boom. So they saw an opportunity before really, you know, the game had exploded. And yeah, I mean, if that ever closed as a snooker club, that would, well, be awful, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, it's my local. It's where I've always played my snooker. So that would be terrible. There used to be a really good pool place in Leeds called the Elbow Rooms.
Right.
I used to play quite a lot of pool. I think that closed down, unfortunately. But I sort of won a couple of times there, won a few things. I think it's when you say how big the pockets are that it lulls you into a sense of security. That's the be all and end all. When obviously the tactics are beyond what. Silly amateur players like me think that you need to be able to know. Because when I play, sort of when you play the average person, they just sort of sling the white all over the place. They can play, but they sling the white all over the place. And because the pockets are so big, they just go in off all the time. They've just got to sort of keep a quiet white on them. But yeah, I enjoyed Judd playing. Now I'd like to see more of it. You were saying Mark Selby's done really well over there.
Well, Mark Selby, as we record this, he's playing in an eight-ball event, the ultimate pool event this evening. It's on Free Sports with Gareth Protts, his brother-in-law. I think the thing about nine and eight-ball pool, for the sort of regular guy and girl, they're more enjoyable to play because a frame of snooker, if you're no good, can last for an hour. And it's no fun for anybody but on a full-size table. But pool in a convivial sort of pub atmosphere is a lot of fun. We've got about 10 minutes left, Dave, so I want to just throw a couple of things over to you. I was interested in, obviously, you know, you say you were a fan in the 80s, you sort of drifted back to snooker. Who are Dave Tindall's sort of favourite players, going back in the day and sort of more modern?
Yeah, so I was very much of the Steve Davis fan club. Not literally like the David Taylor fan club. I was... He just coincided with me getting into snooker, his rise, and I thought that was great because it allowed me to kind of get on board with somebody new rather than someone like, I don't know, maybe like John Spencer or Ray Reardon, although I did really like Ray Reardon, and my first snooker cue was a John Spencer snooker cue. Then I had a Jim Rempe pool cue.
Wow.
It was quite a thing. But yeah, so growing up, Steve Davis was my hero, and obviously 81 was fantastic. That was just, it couldn't have gone better. Sometimes you watch sport and you kind of hope that the guy you've invested all this emotion into will do what he's supposed to do, and Steve Davis did it that year, and it was just perfect. And then in 82, this still gets to me now. I don't exactly wake up in a cold sweat, but When I think of a sport, so I support Liverpool sometimes, and that's been a really good thing to be in the last few years. But during some of the more iffier times, and maybe I thought this in the Champions League final in 2005, I kind of think back to Davis versus Tony Knowles as the ultimate in something that can go wrong. So I started thinking it's possible that a team you're playing against could have eight shots on goal and score all eight, and it's going to be 8-0. And it panics me that could happen, because it did happen. And I watched that unfold as a massive Steve Davis fan. And it was just awful. It was just, I couldn't, I still think that's Got to be one of the biggest shocks I've ever seen. I know Hendry lost. Did he lose 9-0?
To Marcus Campbell, yeah.
Yeah, to Marcus Campbell. But I still think, what event was that? And it wasn't even a massive event, was it?
UK, well, it was the UK. It was non-televised, but I mean, that's, you know, he still got beaten 9-0.
It's still not the world. Yeah, it's still not the world. So for Davis to do that and to get hammered is odd. And bizarrely, I grew up in Whitehaven in Cumbria, and very occasionally we'd get a kind of guest snooker player come and play at the Whitehaven Civic Hall. And Tony Knowles came there to play Jimmy White, and I was a big Jimmy White fan. And I must have blanked it out, but you know my diaries that we read from?
Yeah.
I looked at and found the date. It was about 1984 or 5. And Tony Knowles beat Jimmy White 9-1. I thought, oh, there's something spooky about this. Whenever I go to watch a play that I really love and Tony Knowles hammers them. Oh, that's a bit odd, yeah. What was the original question?
No, I was just asking about your favourite player. So let's update it then. So since you've come back to snooker, I know you saw Ronnie O'Sullivan, I think, at the Crystal this year, didn't you? That was exciting.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously Davis wasn't a great entertainer as such, but I was a big Alex Higgins fan. And I very quickly, when Davis went out in 81, I did jump on the Alex Higgins sort of bandwagon and was thrilled to see him win. By I think at that age, I think I was starting to appreciate the Maverick more. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of thrilled to see John McEnroe winning Wimbledon, having just thought he was a brat when I was a smaller kid. I was beginning to see sort of talent, wayward talent or fragile talent, because with Higgins, because he was so all over the place with his body movement, you were just on edge at every single shot. Plus, you're on edge about how he might react to missing. So definitely Higgins. I really, really didn't like Stephen Hendry.
Ooh.
Which is really odd because I love him now. I think he's great. I just want him to win every match. It's not going to happen. But I think all his commentary is great. I like his musical taste. He likes the Smiths and stuff like that. So I think he's brilliant. But at the time, I don't know. I wouldn't say... Did he drive me away from snooker? Maybe this is an essay I can start to write. But I don't know. It just became too obvious that he could win. And I remember that year when he fell in the shower and broke his arm. And because I was so into Jimmy White back then, it had moved. I was finally, we're going to get... And he still won. And I could not believe it. So he kind of blocked my path a bit. Then we talked about this on another podcast, my... Dallas coma years. I didn't get into it, but so nowadays, massive Ronnie fan. I root for the guys who I see in the Northern Snooker Centre, David Grace and Peter Lyons, Oliver Lyons. So I'd be rooting for them. I do like Neil Robertson, just really good to watch, and I really like Judd. I think one of my perhaps going back again, I think Judd needs to win the world championship again, but I think the world championship needs Judd Trump to win it again. I think with, and this is why I'm more open to it moving, because it might take that. I don't know. I always, this kind of, it's a bit of a strange era, this one, because Judd Trump is kind of the best player, but he's not. And in previous eras, the best player just won a load of world championships, and it's not happening, so it's a bit confusing.
I still think, though, yeah, I agree, but there's still time. Listen, he's 32. If you look at some of the other players, John Higgins, he won his first world title when he was very young. He won his second just before his 32nd birthday, and he's gone on to win 4. Mm. Mark Selby was 30, when he won his first world title. You know, he's gone on to win 4 so far. And even Ronnie, we've seen the longevity he's had. So... You know, we don't know is the point, isn't it? We don't know. We take your stats on board with the left-handers. But here's a question, though, going back to that. So, because Ronnie O'Sullivan plays a lot of shots left-handed, so have you factored that into your calculations or not?
No, that would be far too confusing. I've not got an algorithm that does that.
And in terms of, I'm interested in... Because obviously, you know, I work in snooker full time, and I think you lose a little bit of perspective when you do that, because, you know, it's something that I'm involved in all the time. as a fan who sort of come back to the sport, how much snooker would you watch during the year? There's a lot of people who will watch everything. There are some people who will dip into the big events, as we do with all sports. Where do you sort of stand? Because there's a lot of tournaments going to be coming up shortly.
Yes, at the moment, I'm obviously craving some snooker. Yeah. The World Championship, I will watch every possible session. I'm quite lucky. I'm a freelance sports writer, so I work, well, because of COVID, I work all the time from home. Mm. But I've got the option to always have it on. So yeah. Sometimes it might not fall right because I've got commitment with the kids and stuff like that. But I can sometimes watch a maybe middling event or virtually most of it.
Mm.
But yeah, I watch a lot of snooker nowadays. I just, back to that, why anyone watches snooker, maybe I just find it absorbing.
It's good that you've come back. A lot of people have said that over the lockdown, you know, they've sort of, I guess because people were just stuck indoors and they've just sort of discovered it again and maybe remembered why they liked it in the first place. We're going to have to wrap up there, Dave, but thanks for coming on. That's flown by. We could have gone on. That's flown by. We must have you on again in future weeks, if that's all right. But thank you for your company.
Yeah.
I should say, as we always do, we're proud members of the Sports Social Network. You can check out their other podcasts. You can email us, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. The qualifiers are going on today. As we record this, this is, people say snooker's an eccentric sport, okay? Stephen Hendry's gone to Barnsley for a tournament where they're playing for the Stephen Hendry Trophy. That tournament is the Scottish Open in Wales. So that's where we are at the moment in the snooker world. These qualifiers are dragging on and on. I know why. It's because they make money from the betting streams. Good luck to them. I've said it before, though, I think they could do a bit more with the coverage because it is kind of a bit anonymous. You know, it's almost witness protection scheme anonymous. It's going on. I'm sure people are enjoying it, but it's not exactly being foregrounded very much. But the next event, TV event, will be the Northern Ireland Open, and that starts in a couple of weeks. So we will actually have some snooker. And then after that, they come pretty much thick and fast, which is good news because, as Dave said, we've missed it. But we must wrap up there. Dave, once again, thank you for your company.
Yeah, cheers, Dave.
And we'll be back in some form or other next week.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.